Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Intense Women's Fitness Cast for Tuesday, August 12, 2008. Brought to you in conjunction with our blog at www.intenseathletics.com. That's INTENSEATHLETIX.com. This cast provides information and resources for young girls and women to develop and maintain active and healthy lifestyles through sports or other physical activity. You can call in live to join the discussion at 347-215-8856. I am your host, Rhonda, and today we are talking with Mike Mahler of Aggressive Strength Magazine. Good afternoon, Mike.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Oh, we are happy that you decided to join us and share some sneaky little techniques that we can use to get our young girls ready for extreme athletic performance.
But yeah, I don't know if you should use the word sneaky and young girls in the same sentence again.
Well, we got to have some kind of vice, right?
Speaking of vices, I asked my good friend Josh Henkin to be on the call as well. Josh, are you there?
I am here. Thanks for inviting me.
No, my pleasure. Josh is one of the best strength trainers out there, and he's worked with a lot of basketball players over the years and played basketball himself in college. So I wanted to have him on the call to interject when we start talking about basketball and just in general.
That is perfect. Josh, welcome to the show as well. And before we get started, why don't both of you give us a bit of background about your experience in the fitness industry, how you got started, and kind of who you work with?
Sure. I'll just go first since mine will take about 30 seconds. Josh might be on for about an hour with all of his experience and seminars he's been to. Yeah, I got started about 6 years ago now, and out in Northern Virginia, the first thing I started doing was writing articles for various websites and magazines. I was actually working a 9-to-5 job in the internet industry as a business development manager, and most of those internet companies folded because they didn't have good business models, and they had too many employees with not much to do. So since I was one of those employees with not a whole lot to do, I started writing fitness articles for various magazines and internet websites. And that was kind of the beginning of my fitness career. I started becoming more and more interested in making that my profession. So when I got laid off from my third internet company over 3 years, I decided to stop working for other people and jump into my own thing and actually do something I'm passionate about, which is fitness, something I've been interested in for many years, and make that my vocation. So at the same time, I was getting very interested in a style of training called kettlebell training. And kettlebells basically look like a bowling ball with a suitcase handle on it. And these are the moves you do with kettlebells are very ballistic in nature. One's called a swing, where you swing it between your feet and then snap your hips and drive it to chest level in front of you. One's where you it's called the snatch, where you take it from the floor to overhead. So these are basically full body motions that have a very direct transfer over to any athletic endeavor. You're learning how to use your body as one unit. So as I got more exposed to kettlebell training, I realized that this would be something that would definitely take off with a lot of people because it's portable. You can do it at home. You only need one or two kettlebells. And it's not going to give you so much the bulky bodybuilder type physique, but more of a lean, strong, sprinter's type physique and develop incredible muscular endurance. So I made that my focal point. I've always done other stuff beyond kettlebells. I've always talked about a variety of training systems, and I've talked about nutrition and different things. So I don't just call myself a kettlebell instructor. I'm more of a strength trainer with kettlebells as my focus. But for many years after I got into the business, kettlebells was my primary focus in terms of getting that information out to people. And I did that through seminars all around the country. I did some overseas. I started making some fitness videos focused on kettlebells, writing some e-books, and writing a ton of articles for magazines such as Muscle and Fitness, Ironman Magazine, Ironman Magazine Japan, Planet Muscle, just a variety of different publications online and offline to really get that information out there. And in the last couple of years, kettlebells has started to become very, very popular. You even see kettlebells in Target now and a lot of the sporting goods stores. Josh has been doing kettlebells for many years as well with his athletes and his people and incorporating it into his system. So that's basically in a nutshell how I got started. And now I'm more of a fitness information provider in the sense that most of my time is spent keeping a lot of good information on my website, which is updated through my online magazine once or twice a month, adding a ton of articles from myself and other strength coaches like Josh and some of the other great people in the industry on my website, and making more information products, promoting really big seminars where I get a lot of experts to come out for 2 days, and then we film those and make it into videos to sell to the public. So at this stage of my career, I still do seminars, but I'm more focused on making actual high-quality information products, more of a producer, if you will, and getting that information out there.
Great, great. Josh, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I think my goal is I'm only going to take a half hour, so I'll make it quick. Basically, my journey started actually through basketball. I've been playing since I was about 10, and about my freshman year of high school, I suffered a horrible ankle injury that basically put me out for 12 weeks, and there was nothing I could do basketball-wise, so my older brother actually got me started lifting, and through lifting, I found just a whole area that most basketball players never ventured into, which when I was able to come back from the injury, I was so much stronger and faster that it gave me an extra edge and on the court. And then that led to some successful years in high school and then an opportunity to play at a Pac-10 school here in Arizona. So that opportunity then was still extended by the fact that not too many basketball players were still strength training. Most of them, you know, love to play basketball, but not too many love to train for basketball. And, you know, I suffered another bad back injury a couple of years before, and that got re-aggravated. So also going through a whole therapy side, I got to see what it's like to not only be an athlete but an injured athlete and how much misinformation there is. And actually that helped my path because my own interest in my own health and performance led me to finding, you know, great training implements and methodologies like kettlebells. And I got the opportunity to work with many college and professional basketball players and many high school as well. And I think the biggest thing I could just play off of what Mike said is that a lot of coaches, they try to fit people into their system rather than to try to develop a system for their people. So in the case of basketball, it's a very unique sport because you're talking about people with a lot of different type of leverages and issues, and you know, especially with female athletes, you got some unique issues I'm sure Mike will touch upon as well. And kettlebells can be the perfect tool to actually work around some of these normal objections that basketball players might have in their training.
I'm glad that you mentioned that about the female athletes and also your comment related to finding a program that fits the individual versus having the individual fit into your program. For women, you know, they are built differently than men. Their physical demands, their physical ability is different than men, so it's very important to be specific when dealing with them, particularly from a strength and conditioning perspective.
Oh, yeah, that's a great point. And one of the reasons that people fail in general with training is the fact that they don't have a program that's personalized to them as an individual. What they're doing is going to a magazine or just pulling a program out of a book, and a program out of a book is going to be generic, and it may be a good program, but it's not taking you as an individual into account. And that's the reason why so many people fail on training programs is that, like Josh said, you have to personalize the program to the individual rather than taking a cookie-cutter approach and just passing out to people. And a lot of trainers make the mistake of just putting their clients on whatever they're doing at the time. So if they're doing a certain program and it's doing well for them, they go, okay, I'm going to have all my clients do the same thing. And it's not necessarily going to work well for them at all.
You're absolutely right. So as we go through our discussion today, I'm going to be asking both of you about some resources and some things that not only can athletes do, but also just women who are trying to get fit in general do to kind of get started and figure out, you know, what strength they should use, what types of exercises that they should incorporate, things like that. But we'll get into that as we move forward in the discussion.
Sounds great.
But before we do that, let's talk a little bit about kettlebells. I understand that this is really an old-school piece of equipment that's been around for years, and it's just recently been introduced into the U.S. as a method of strength training.
Yeah, kettlebells have a really strong tradition in the physical culture history. Basically, they were used by a lot of the old-time strongmen in the U.S., in Europe, in Eastern Europe, as part of their overall training regimen. In Russia, it's actually a sport that revolves around kettlebell training in which athletes compete in two of the exercises. One of them is called the snatch, which is where you take one kettlebell from the floor to overhead and one in uninterrupted motion. And the other one is called the jerk, where you have two kettlebells at chest level. You're holding them in what we call the rack position right below the chin. And you use your legs and upper body to drive the weights overhead. So it's another full body exercise. And what these athletes do is do as many total reps as possible in a 10-minute time frame. So they can't put the weights down for 10 minutes. They have to do as many reps as possible. Now, just surviving a 10-minute set with light kettlebells is very humbling. When people hear about this, they think, oh, well, you know, 10 minutes with a light kettlebell doesn't sound that difficult. And the first time anyone ever tries it, by minute two, they're dying, they're wolfing. So that's an incredible way to build endurance. That's not the only use of kettlebells, but in Russia, that's the sport is basically the driving force of getting kettlebell information out there. They're also used in the military quite a bit for their conditioning. So rather than just doing calisthenics and so forth, kettlebells in many of the units out there played a critical role in their training. But back to the U.S., a lot of people use kettlebells. In fact, when I used to work out on the beach in Los Angeles, I used to have a lot of older gentlemen come up to me and talk about, oh, I haven't seen these kettlebells for years. They used to be in every gym out here in the 1950s and so forth. And if you look at a lot of old magazines of gyms, old school type gyms, what you would see are barbells, some power rings for doing gymnastic type moves, and then you would see a rack of kettlebells, kind of like the way you see dumbbells now. So the way they used kettlebells was more bodybuilding type motions. They would do the traditional chest presses and things like that with it. Some of the old-time strongmen did the ballistic motions we're talking about, where we're basically using momentum and speed to develop force production. And again, that revolves around the ballistic motions of swings, snatches, and the jerks. So kettlebells really, it's hard to know where exactly they originated from. People always ask me that question, where did they start and so forth. And the reality is variations of kettlebells have been in a lot of different places. Even in China, in the martial arts community, they have something called a padlock, which looks just like a kettlebell. Instead of a ball with the handle, it's kind of a big brick with the handle. And they do similar motions with that as well. So this style of training has been, it's almost kind of a world phenomenon. It's something that's been around for a long time in a lot of different parts of the world.
Now, what's the difference between using just a plain old dumbbell? I mean, it's still a weight and you're performing the same or similar exercises. Why is the kettlebell training different?
Well, that's a great question. And one thing is, as strength coaches who use a lot of implements, like Josh and I do with our athletes and with ourselves, one thing at the end of the day is resistance. So whether you're using a dumbbell or a barbell or a sandbag, using a heavy bag, resistance definitely at the end of the day is resistance. What makes the kettlebell different than a dumbbell, and I'm not going to say that kettlebells are superior to dumbbells and that you should use kettlebells instead of dumbbells. There's no reason why you can't use both. But the kettlebells are really well designed for those ballistic motions that we're talking about. Because of the way the handle and the ball are lined up, you can hold on one second. Let me get away from my dog before he ruins the ball. Hey, don't follow me. Don't follow me. Now, the way the kettlebell is designed is perfect for these ballistic motions that we're talking about, especially where you're holding it in the rack position, where you're holding it below your chin. It can rest right into your upper body for a nice, smooth transition going into the other motions. Now, with the dumbbell, dumbbells are great for a lot of motions, but they're not built real well for the motions we're talking about. High repetition, clean and presses, high repetition, clean and jerks, high repetition swings, snatches. Kettlebells are just made perfectly well for those motions. The off-centered weight also causes a ton of stabilizer muscles to come into play. When you're holding a kettlebell at chest level, let's say it's in your right hand. The bell is on the outside of your hand, so it's trying to pull away from you, and your body has to stabilize that. So you're getting a great core workout just holding a kettlebell in place. It's always trying to pull you off your center of gravity, so that's one of the key benefits. The thick handles is another one because it basically turns every exercise into a grip exercise without having to focus on grip separately. So every time you pick up a kettlebell, your grip comes into play right away. Josh, you want to add anything to that?
I just want to interject a couple of things that are probably pretty relevant, especially about the topic we're talking about. A couple other items are, for example, as Mike mentioned, some of the positions that you go in with kettlebells can be far more comfortable than with a dumbbell, and that's very applicable, especially if you're dealing with young athletes or a lot of times female athletes that traditionally don't have a lot of upper body mass. So, for example, a barbell squat may be quite uncomfortable on a young lady high school, junior high age trying to squat because they just don't have the upper body mass to support the bar. Kettlebells allow them to perform the exercise with appropriate resistance, but allows them to do it in a more comfortable manner. And also, because of the position of the bells, as Mike alluded to, you get a great core workout. And the way we view core training is basically, you know, the body's ability to resist motion as well as be able to produce it. So a lot of athletes, they spend all their time trying to produce motion with their core rather than also trying to, you know, as Mike said, stabilize and resist movement. So the kettlebells actually are a phenomenal way of integrating whole body movements and athleticism. And they're different than dumbbells because of the many reasons Mike mentioned, but also because you have more variations typically that are in your arsenal. So you can take a simple movement like a lunge or squat and come up with about 10 different variations just with one or two kettlebells.
The one thing that's great about kettlebells as well also is the fact that they really build a lot of shoulder stability. A lot of people that find overhead work, which is a very important component of athletic strength, basically taking a weight overhead and being able to stabilize it overhead builds a strong foundation. What a lot of athletes find with barbells and dumbbells is that they tend to cause some stress on the shoulders and that the athlete tends to lock out in front of the head, causing even more stress if they lack shoulder flexibility. The kettlebell, because of the way it's off-centered, has a tendency to pull the shoulder back. So you lock out in a much more comfortable position where the bell is lined up with your head or slightly behind your head, which helps build more shoulder stability. A lot of chiropractors and a lot of rehab people are actually incorporating kettlebells in with rehabilitating their clients who have had shoulder injuries and other injuries as well.
Okay. Well, that's definitely useful on the basketball court, particularly when you're up against a bit of contact, being able to maintain your core and stabilize your body so that you can still perform without falling over, being bumped to the floor very easily.
And that's actually a great point, and it brings up another benefit of kettlebells is that there's a shock absorption mechanism with kettlebells. In other words, when you pick up a kettlebell and you bring it to the rack position, you have to absorb the shock of the kettlebell, your hand going around the kettlebell and bracing it into your body, just as you would have to absorb shock of bracing for an opponent, slamming into you, or slamming into an opponent, and so forth. So you develop a lot of strong tendon strength. And again, you're building your body as one strong foundation. What I don't like about a lot of isolation work where you're doing curls and you're doing tricep pushdowns, then you're doing leg curls and you're doing leg extensions and all that, and all of that stuff has a place within a program, usually a very small place within a program. It tends to be too much of it emphasized by a lot of people, is that you're not teaching your body how to work as one unit. In every athletic sport that I see, maybe the exception of arm wrestling or something, is a full body application. And even in something like arm wrestling, you're not using your arm to be your opponent. It's a full body demonstration of tension and strength. So basically, teaching the body how to work as one unit, how to build that synergy between the lower and upper body, is definitely very applicable to any sport, in particular basketball.
Now, I work with a lot of young kids, typically starting at around age 10 on up through high school. We do a lot of body weight exercises more so than, you know, using actual weights. Wondering, though, at what age would you recommend for girls in particular to start using weights, be they dumbbells or the kettlebells?
Josh, you want to jump on
that a little bit there? Yeah. You know, we have kids as young as 10 starting to use them. And let me just go over sort of the progression and the concept behind it. For one thing, you know, you get a lot of apprehension from coaches and parents with kids using weights at young ages. It really depends upon how you're, you know, utilizing the implement. You know, we're not going to stress maximal load, so we're not going to make kids lift heavy, heavy weights, which is usually where the problem would arise. So what we're dealing with is more learning the movement patterns and being exposed to the exercises. So as they progress through the years, they are able to do more complex exercises and programs. One big mistake that a lot of coaches make through school programs is that the freshmen are doing the same programs as the seniors. And if you think about it, there's no other time in school that kids do that for the most part. You know, so what we do too is also have to realize that when kids are running and jumping, they're exposing their body to 8 to 10 times their body weight on their joints. Okay, so a 18-pound kettlebell comes nowhere near producing the amount of force on a young person's body than just simple running and jumping does. Now, what the problem then is that now we don't give the kids any background to tolerate those forces. So most countries that you'll find, they start strength training quite early. And it's American fear, it seems like more so than anything, that we're going to hurt these kids. But in actuality, we're hurting them because we're not preparing them to deal with the nature of the sport. So what we start with is just basically teaching them proper postures and lifting positions and working with very fundamental lifting patterns. For example, the deadlift. They may learn how to squat. There's some wonderful squat variations that are very easy and safe to learn with a kettlebell that actually can give feedback upon the young athlete upon how to squat correctly. So there's a lot of advantages to implementing the kettlebell at a young age so that when they get older, they have the background, the strength training, you know, as Mike mentioned, tendon ligament strength, to tolerate more complex and harder lifting programs. So I think that it would be wise for any coach or program to actually start implementing them at a very early age. But you just have to use it wisely. You have to use very moderate loads, make sure that the kids don't feel overstressed, and give them short exposures. You know, think of it as you know, Mike and I like to say, more of a lesson than a workout. And if you take that approach where you're trying to teach them good movement skills, you're going to find that you really have minimal problems with injuries.
Yeah, and a lot of the kids that go through Josh's program, they have such an advantage over other athletes that have not gone through that conditioning because they have such a strong mind-muscle connection. Their coordination is great. They know how to use their body in synergy. They know how to apply that force in force production. And Josh made another great point in the fact that a lot of people feel that if they don't wipe out their athletes or they don't wipe out themselves when they're working out, then they're not getting a good workout in. I mean, people even wear it as a badge of honor. Oh, I'm so wiped out from my squatting yesterday, I can't even go to the bathroom. I can't even get off the toilet seat. I can't even get off the couch. Hooray for me. And what you're doing, just a regular person, I mean, who wants to be that wiped out, especially if you have other responsibilities, which all of us do. If you have a regular job, you can't even walk up the stairs to your office now because you worked out so hard. But for an athlete, that's just disastrous. I mean, imagine an athlete completely wiped out from a workout and they have to play a game the next day or they have to work on their skill sets for the actual sport the next day or later that day. So training has to be very personalized and specific, and it has to be almost like medicine where it's a very precise dose that's looked at very carefully by the strength coach that's working with the athlete, so you're modifying that intensity accordingly.
Now, Josh, you mentioned the working on proper movements and so forth at the early ages. Are they mm-hmm. also using the actual kettlebells at that time? Or
they absolutely do. You know, the great thing about kettlebells is they are weights, and they do come in a wide variety of weights. So you can start them with as small as probably a 9-pound kettlebell, you know, for some upper body stabilization drills, to, you know, 18, 26-pound kettlebells, learning how to again, correct lifting postures, which has a great carryover. I mean, if we analyze the deadlift, basically that's just very similar to getting into an athletic stance. And nowadays, it is appalling how many young athletes cannot get into an athletic stance. They don't have the flexibility, the strength, the endurance to maintain it, and yet they want to go out and play their sport. So you can definitely start implementing kettlebells in very moderate loads. Like I said, no, as low as 9 pounds to, you know, a lot of our young people can go up to 35-pound kettlebells pretty quickly, and they're very safe, and you know that they end up being the ones that tend to be most resilient to injury.
Is 9 pounds the lowest weight that the kettlebells come in, or?
It can be even lower than that, but if you get too low, then it's almost a joke at that point. You might as well have kids running around with soup cans. It just becomes too light. Like, for example, there's some kettlebells that are about 4 pounds, but they're so small, and people find that they're not comfortable at all either because the bell is so small, it's really pushing right into the bone right below the hand. So I think 9 pounds is a good starting weight. That's big enough where there's some actual resistance. And you would just focus young people on very basic exercises. Like Josh said, you're not going to have them doing any maximum lifts. You're not trying to have them do any powerlifting, which is not going to help with their sport. But, I mean, you're already doing bodyweight calisthenics and bodyweight push-ups, squats, that kind of thing. That's all great stuff. And kettlebells can merge into that stuff very well. So, for example, you can have them hold on to the kettlebell while they're doing the bodyweight squats, working on that technique. They can do squat thrusts, holding on to a kettlebell, and so forth. So it's actually, you can even look at it as a way to just add some resistance to a lot of that bodyweight stuff you're doing already.
Oh, I see. That makes sense. Now, Josh, you just mentioned, too, that a lot of kids don't know how to do proper stance and they don't have the ability or I don't know. They just don't know how to do it. For me, a lot of times it's a mental thing. And I know, Mike, you talked about how kettlebell training also helps to build the mindset of an athlete. Can you go into a little bit more about that? Because oftentimes we get kids and we tend to find ourselves going over and over and over again about the same thing, like defensive stance as an example. Get low, you know, sit, hands out, feet ready to move, but inevitably they do some lazy something or another that they think is called defense.
Well, Josh and I have had a lot of workshops. We've done some together, and what we have found is that when we're trying to teach a technique to people, oftentimes you start with one method. It's like, okay, we're going to have you work on the squat. First thing we're going to do is have you go up against a wall, squat down, and then that just doesn't work. So you have a choice. Some coaches just keep pushing that. It's like, come on, why don't you get it? Just keep going, keep doing it. And obviously that method is not working with that individual, so it's, you might as well just push their head into the wall over and over again and hope they get it. It's going to be about as effective as that. So oftentimes what we find is like, all right, listen, try doing this. Just hold on to a kettlebell and sit back as if you're sitting back into a chair. And then, bam, they go right into it. And what they couldn't do a few seconds ago, they can do right away. So there's always, you want to have as many different of these techniques, of these tricks, as you will, in your arsenal. Because when you're trying to just teach one thing one way, it's not going to work for everyone. In fact, I think that's a big problem with actual teaching in school in general, is that the teacher is teaching all of the students. Let's say you have 30 students in the room using one methodology. So there's going to be maybe a certain percentage of the students that gravitate towards that. It resonates well with them. While the other students who are not dumb, they're intelligent, but that method is just not getting through to them. So they're just left out. And what happens with us is that when we're trying to do something and it's not getting across to us, like we're reading and we see a word we don't understand, our brain automatically shuts off at that point. So as an instructor, when you're teaching something to someone and they're trying it and they're just not getting it, they're not going to work through that. They're just going to shut off. Their brain's just going to go, you know what, I don't really understand what he's talking about, so I'm just going to just shut off right now. And the mistake, again, that a lot of people make is they just try to push someone through that. They start using harsh language or say, come on, why don't you get it? And that's just not the most approach. That's not the best approach to make. A really good martial arts instructor knows this really well. They have 50 different ways to teach one thing. Just so in case one method doesn't work, they can go right into the next transition.
Okay.
And just to add on to that, you know, I think there's a lot of strength training that goes on for a lot of sports where there's not a lot of purpose behind it. So, you know, a lot of times when we're designing a program, it's not that we're doing an exercise because we want to strengthen the shoulders or that we just want to, you know, get the quads going or things like that. In fact, I think the squat may be the least, you know, helpful exercise for a lot of basketball players because there's very few times that you actually do a squat in basketball. You know, if you look at, you know, you mentioned the defensive stance, that is a very similar position to a swing or a deadlift. So it's funny that we very rarely look at our exercises as teaching good movement patterns that are actually applicable to sport. And one of my biggest pet peeves are coaches and parents that want sport-specific programs. They think they have to do very unique things when, in actuality, they're missing the bigger picture that their fundamental exercises are not reinforcing the movements that they want to see performed in the sport.
Yeah, for example, some people have taken the whole sport-specific to a level where it's nonsensical, where, for example, let's have a 5-pound medicine ball instead of a basketball and just throw that and try to throw that into the hoop, or let's go do some boxing where we're holding on the 25-pound dumbbells. And what in theory, all that stuff sounds great. It's like, okay, I'm going to hit a bag with 25-pound dumbbells, so once I drop the dumbbells, I should be able to generate a lot more force into those punches. And what happens is you just ruin the technique, so the technique doesn't transfer at all, and you actually make it less productive.
You mentioned
Josh, why don't you jump in while I run to another run?
Okay, no problem.
Josh, you mentioned about the squats. I guess the pup wanted to participate and give his 2 cents too. You mentioned that squats aren't necessarily effective, but when we have girls who most of their injuries tend to come from ACL tears and so forth, don't squats become critical for them?
Well, no, don't completely misunderstand. Squats are valuable, but they're often overdone. And if you're referring to specifically ACL injuries, well, non-contact ACL injuries, which are women are more prone to, so you're even talking about injuries that do not occur from a direct trauma. They occur from an inability to decelerate the body. And if you look at the body's decelerators, they're the hamstrings and also as well as the glutes. And if you look at the typical squat done by most athletes, they're very quadricep dominant. Well, your quadriceps are not the braking mechanisms of the knee. So what you had developed is an inappropriate ratio of your quadriceps, the front of your thigh, to the actual braking guys, your hamstrings, to the back. So most athletes that need appropriate ACL protection should be doing things like swings, snatches, deadlifts, and so forth, because that is what activates the glutes and the hamstrings in a synergistic manner and actually will protect the knee more so. So what a lot of professionals are still in the dark about is it's not the actual front of the thigh that protects the knee, it's the back side of the thigh.
I see. That makes sense. That makes sense. So we've got some kids here, and, of course, they're girls. That's what we've been talking about. How do we get them started? Where do we start with this? I mean, I know that the kettlebells are available, in various places, but we've got a set of kettlebells. We've got a gym. We've got a gym full of kids. Now what?
Well, what you have to do is obviously look at what you have available and how many kids you have available. We do a lot of team training, and you can get a lot done if you – number one is to be very organized. So it's not to come in, look around, and decide what you're going to do right then. Having a plan as far as the equipment, space, and kids available is going to be crucial in developing the appropriate program. For example, we may start the workout by doing a very dynamic type of warm-up, integrating some calisthenics as well as dynamic flexibility. We may work on footwork through different means, splitting up a group in, for example, using simple jump ropes, agility ladders, different band drills, and then we may move into a strength section that, again, may reintroduce some more challenging bodyweight exercises, kettlebell drills. You may use sprints, and, you can have – look what you just covered right there. You covered speed, power, strength, flexibility within a very short time frame. And especially with younger kids, it's great to do that in some of a circuit manner. It allows them to do a great variety of things, because one of the worst things that coaches do right now is they make kids very specialized. So the more exposure the kids can have to different movement patterns, the actual better athlete they'll become and the less prone to injury they'll become. What made the Eastern Europeans so dominant in their Olympics for so many years, people think it was drug use. It's quite the contrary. It's actually what China's using now is where they would take kids at a very early age and have them do lots of different sports. In fact, it was funny, at Wake Forest University, there was two basketball players, 6'9 and I believe 6'8, that came from Lithuania, and they would actually help instruct the Wake Forest gymnastics team, because as growing up in Lithuania, they got exposed to gymnastics, and they would have to do tumbling and, very, fundamental drills, but they became very athletic and explosive from adding that component. So you can borrow a lot of great techniques. I think we've become somewhat narrow-minded and focused on what we want to do because we look at the sport itself, and the younger the athlete, the more exposure they have to have to different things to become a great athlete. Because number one is you're a great basketball player if you can become a great athlete first, and then you can very easily pick up the game.
I see.
Yeah, that's just a great whole segment right there by Josh, and the fact that you want to look at a basketball player as an athlete first. You develop a good athlete, they can carry over into a variety of activities. And the same thing goes with training. You want to have certain basic parameters covered, but then add variety in there because, for example, if I wanted to improve the military press, let's say that's one of my big goals, to press a lot of weight overhead, and I could just focus on, let's say it was a barbell military press that I really want to improve. So some would say, okay, just do the barbell military press all the time. Just do that as often as possible. Keep working on just that move itself. Well, what's going to happen is you're going to burn out in that move. Your central nervous system is going to start becoming less efficient rather than more efficient. A much more fun way to work that move would be to use a variety of moves that are similar but different. So, for example, you could even train it 5 days a week. Monday, you would do a barbell press. Tuesday, do a kettlebell press. Wednesday, do a sandbag press. Sandbag training is one of the big things Josh is into. He's got some great information on that. On Wednesday, you could do a thick bar where you use a thicker barbell or use resistance bands or you do handstand push-ups. And what's going to happen is you're going to get better at the actual skill of taking resistance overhead. So you're going to get better at specifics and or in general. And that's a great way to look at athletics as well, as rather than just have them do one thing over and over and over again all the time, focus on adding some variety and improving from a much deeper level.
So basically with the kettlebells, you don't necessarily throw away everything else you have. You just integrate it into whatever you're currently
doing. That would be a big mistake. And unfortunately, there's a lot of marketing driven behind kettlebells where it's touted as the be-all, end-all, and this is all you need and so forth. And I'll be the first to say that you can get a great workout with just kettlebells. I know because I did it. When I lived in L.A., I lived in an apartment, so I didn't have a squat rack in my living room and a bunch of sandbags in the corner in my kitchen. You have a limited amount of space, so I had a couple of kettlebells, which I could take to the park or the beach and get a great full-body workout, no problem. But if you look at all the top strength coaches like Josh and Ethan Reeve at Wake Forest University and a lot of the professional athletic strength coaches, the guys who are doing a great job, Louis Simmons, powerlifting coach, what these people do is use a variety of implements. They're not just married to one implement where they're saying this is all you do. So when you get into kettlebell training, you're not forgetting everything else you've done before it. I mean, some of it you might want to forget. For example, if you do super slow training or high intensity training, yeah, forget about that stuff. You can throw that part away. You don't need to keep that in your arsenal. But smart strength coach will take kettlebells and incorporate it into whatever else they're doing, and then offer as much variety and offer as much comprehensive benefit to the athlete.
Sounds good. Mike, why don't you tell us a little bit about your five pillars of kettlebell training?
Okay, sure. Basically, the five pillars of kettlebell training is just a simple way to make sure that the trainee is doing a full-body workout, because we have a tendency to focus on what we like to do. For example, men tend to overdo the upper body. Women tend to overdo the lower body. If you go to any gym, you see all the women in the leg section. You see all the guys in the upper body section. All the women are on cardio. All the men are doing curls in the squat rack. So with the five pillars of kettlebell training, it's one is a press or an overhead movement. So this is where you're taking the kettlebell from that rack position where you're holding it below the chin in the upper body. It can either be a military press or what's called a push press where you use the legs to drive the weight overhead. So it's basically a vertical lift overhead. The next one would be a row, some kind of rowing motion. This can be a pull-up. In the context of kettlebells, it would be a bent-over row where your upper body is horizontal to the floor and you're pulling a weight to your chest or your stomach, sternum, etc. So this balances out the pressing motion. And then you're going to do some kind of squatting motion, which can be a front squat where you're holding one or two kettlebells, again, in that same rack position, squatting all the way down. And then you're doing something for the hamstrings, for the posterior chain, which would be a ballistic motion. This would be either a swing or what we call a snatch. It could be done with one kettlebell, two kettlebells, no problem, cleans. These are all ballistic exercises that really work the hamstrings and the posterior chain very well. And then the final pillar would be something more specific to the core. And there's a lot of really good exercises with kettlebells for the midsection and the lower back. One's called the windmill, where you hold the weight overhead and then you just shift your weight in the opposite direction. Really good for shoulder stability. Another one's called the Turkish get-up, where you lie on the floor with the kettlebell locked out like you would at the end of a bench press, and you hold it in that position and go from a lying position to a standing position and then back down to the lying position with the kettlebell locked out the entire time. So that's a tremendous full-body developer in addition to a shoulder stabilizer, as well as a really good core exercise. So if an athlete or just a general person, let's say someone that just wants general fitness, they just want to have a good full-body strength training workout, if you cover those five pillars, you're getting a full-body good workout. What I'm basically saying is it's covering about 80% or more of what you'll need for a good strength training regimen. Anything beyond that is just going to be more specialized work and so forth.
Okay. That sounds good. I do want to talk a little bit about nutrition in a bit here, but before we do that, what I'd like to do, Josh and Mike, is kind of go over similar to what you just did with the, and it may be the same with the five pillars of kettlebell training, is kind of talk about one for an athletic girls basketball team and two for just women in general looking to get started. Where can they go? Do you guys have websites they can visit that have some sort of getting started guide?
Yeah, Josh has a really good website. One is called sandbagexercises.com. And sandbag training, we probably don't have a lot of time to jump into that. Maybe we can save that for another topic down the road. But sandbag training is a really, really great way to train athletes. It's just a brutal way to train, especially for wrestlers. But when you're picking up a sandbag, I mean, you want to talk about stabilization and something very specific to working against an opponent. And Josh definitely by far has the best information out there on sandbag training via his videos and books. And my website is mikemahler.com, and it's just my name, all one word. And there's a section on there where I cover all the basic kettlebell exercises. All that information is free for people to look at. There's a ton of free articles on kettlebell training there, and there's a ton of articles written by other great strength coaches. And my online magazine, all of this stuff is free, so someone can easily go to my website and educate themselves. You have a couple other websites, don't you, Josh?
Yeah, we're changing the Sandbag one to we're just upgraded to sandbagfitnesssystems.com. So we're getting a little more integrated, showing people, again, like Mike, we have a lot of free material. That's our primary site. We not only go over sandbags, but also how to integrate kettlebells and different implements. They're very practical for athletes and coaches and also just people interested in general fitness. You know, those pillars Mike hit upon are basically applicable to anyone who wants to get in great shape. I think the one trap that a lot of coaches fall into is they think they have to do a lot of exercises. And the truth of the matter, as Mike could vouch for, is probably if you focus on a couple of key ones, you'll get far more production than if you try to do about a million different movements for different muscles.
Okay. What do you think would be critical for girls who are kind of starting to use the kettlebells? Give me three or so exercises that they should definitely start working on when they integrate the kettlebells into their workout plan.
Well, I can give you my three real fast. One is a swing, which is a very dynamic action that teaches basically how to utilize the backside of the thighs and hips in a very quick manner. So it's very practical for building eccentric strength, which is going to carry over to future jumping activities and drills. A lot of basketball coaches jump too fast into doing jumping drills and don't have the preparation for young ladies especially. The second one would be the one-legged deadlift, and that teaches great stabilization of the ankle and foot joint, along with, again, teaching stability of the hip and pelvis. And then my other one would be definitely the overhead clean and press, and I know Mike's a big fan of that one, because there probably is no better overall body exercise that teaches so many different components of strength and flexibility as that drill.
What was the last one again?
It's the clean and press. So you will bring weight from the ground up to your shoulders and then from your shoulders above your head.
Okay.
It's a really good combination exercise where you rip a kettlebell off the floor and you bring it to the rack position. That's called the clean. And then instead of going back down and doing another repetition of the clean, you press it overhead. Then you bring it back down to the shoulder, and then you bring it back down to the starting position, and you repeat. So if you did, especially the double clean and press, if you did 10 repetitions of that, I mean, you're getting some really nice strength endurance. And, you're really learning how to teach your body how to work as one unit. You're learning how to transition power from the lower body to the upper body. You're generating power from the lower body, and instead of letting it dissipate, you're transferring it into an upper body motion. So it's a really powerful deal. But those three exercises that Josh went over, I mean, if any trainer out there gets a client to do those three exercises for any period of time, they're going to have a client for life, because not only will you develop strong strength and conditioning for athletics, but from an aesthetic point of view, I mean, women love the swings and the one-legged deadlifts because it works all of those backside muscles. It works the glutes, the hamstrings, makes the back really tightened up and so forth. It doesn't make you really bulky. A lot of women are fearful of weight training because they think it's going to make them really bulky. That really doesn't happen. It doesn't really happen in general that easily, but more specifically with kettlebells, you'll find that a lot of the women who use kettlebells just get really lean and sleek physiques.
Yeah, you mentioned that earlier, and I've seen some of the pictures of women who have incorporated kettlebell training, and they are very lean looking and kind of strenuous instead of bulky.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Do you have any additional exercises you would recommend for the athlete?
Well, I think one exercise that women really like and that I've seen a lot of great results occur with is one that's called a windmill, which is a really good core exercise. So it really tightens up the midsection. It also works the hamstrings and the glutes to a secondary degree, as well as helping stabilize the shoulder. That's an exercise that women fall in love with immediately. And women tend to be really good at it as well because they're not as tight in the hip flexors as men are. So women really gravitate towards that one. But so the one-legged deadlift that Josh covers, that's one that women love. really works the glutes. The swing is really good for, again, the backside muscles. The clean and press is a great full body exercise, really tightens up the triceps, teaches that full body synergy. And then you throw in the windmill or that Turkish get-up we covered earlier, and now you're developing an even stronger and resilient as well as an aesthetic pleasing midsection as well.
You called it a Turkish get-up?
Yeah, it's called a Turkish get-up. Josh can talk more about that. He's done a lot of wrestling with some Turkish guys.
He was doing some training. They're pretty cute, though. It's a good exercise because it was actually derived by wrestlers, and you know, if you break free of, you know, thinking in traditional terms for a lot of us of athletic development, you know, the two sports I think, you know, Mike would probably agree with that have some of the best actually just pure athletes is wrestling and gymnastics.
Oh yeah, by far.
Yeah, and if you can think outside the box, you know, and Mike mentioned, you know, the whole idea of marketing, you know, in the world of marketing, the best marketers usually, you know, go to other industries to find their great ideas. And, you know, it's funny, in athletic development, we seem to stay content just staying with traditional means within the given sport. And when coaches can think outside the box and derive and then steal, you know, concepts and ideas from some of the best athletes in the world, it's only going to enhance the training that you produce.
Now let's jump from the athlete to just the woman who wants to get physically fit. Are there going to be the same exercises that you recommend, or do you have something different that they should use?
Well, yeah, I mean, something really fast. Mine will take 2 seconds. For us, it's the same because I don't know a woman that doesn't want to look like a great athlete. You know, women always say they don't want to look like bodybuilders, but they always point to, let's say, a Gabrielle Reese or a nice, you know, lean, you know, looking lady, and I don't know, you know, Mike's opinion there, but it's pretty much the same for us.
If you look at a lot of the actresses that are really in vogue right now in terms of a lot of people want to look like them, I mean, like a Jessica Biel, she trains like an athlete. A lot of these people train like athletes. Jennifer Lopez goes to a trainer in L.A. where she does a lot of plyometrics and stuff like that, where she's training like an athlete. So a lot of these women look that way because they're not doing a lot of it's genetics and good diet as well as having a great trainer, but they're not doing a lot of the traditional bodybuilding type stuff anymore, and they're developing these great athletic, healthy-looking physiques, and that's what a lot of women were gravitating towards.
What about Serena Williams? Do you know
Serena Williams? I think she's just a genetic. She's got some serious genetic gifts for muscle development because, as far as I know, she doesn't do a lot of weight training or anything else like that. And tennis and some other stuff is her primary source of exercise, and her physique has developed the way it has from largely just genetics, unless I'm mistaken. Josh, maybe you have some insight on what her training background is.
Well, not too much, but I'll say that there's obviously always an exception to the rule, and you know, there's also, you know, when we say like an athlete, you know, if you look at Serena Williams or any of the Olympians, you know, the amount of hours spent training is just so immense. The average woman is not going to spend the same amount of time training, but they can borrow concepts and methods that will give them probably results that are more practical for their lifestyle and what they want to achieve.
Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of funny when people are fearful of certain results. Like I work with some guys, for example, who say, I don't want to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's like, well, don't worry, right? Because even if you did, the chances of you achieving that level are very minimal. So it's not something that's going to happen by accident. We're not going to put someone on a program and we're shocked going, wow, we didn't realize you were going to put on 50 pounds of muscle in a month just doing this program. What a shock to us.
Well, gentlemen, we do have a listener in the chat room. His name is Steve, and he says that he wants to get skinny. What can you recommend for Steve?
Okay, he wants to get skinny. Can this person be a little bit more specific on, is it, this person's in the chat room so they can give us some more information?
Yes. Steve, why don't you give us a little bit more information?
Where is the person at right now, and what exactly are they trying to achieve? They just want to lose weight, they're overweight, and they just want to drop some pounds, or is it more than that?
Well, let's see if Steve will respond, and then maybe we can give him some advice.
I mean, just losing weight in general is 70% diet. So we can talk about training all day long, but if you have a crappy diet, if you go to Krispy Kreme every day after a workout, you're just not going to lose weight. And the average American diet is just appalling. It's what most people eat is not even food, in my opinion. It's just a combination of chemicals with a little bit of food flavoring in it. And that's 90% of what people are eating every day. It's just garbage. I mean, most of what we see in a supermarket is not even worthy of any consumption by any living thing. So, I mean, just someone who just wants to lose weight, yeah, we can definitely design some good training programs, but a lot of that is diet. You really clean up your diet. You want to eat as much real food as possible, fruits, vegetables, lean meats, lean dairy, lean nuts and seeds, legumes and so forth. I mean, these are real food sources. If it comes in a bag and it has a bunch of ingredients that you can't understand, then it's not something you should be eating. So diet philosophy, from my point of view, is very simple. You want to focus on real food. You want to make sure you're getting enough water. You want to make sure that you're getting focused on nourishing yourself with as much high-quality nutrition as possible. From just a fat loss point of view, then we can look at interval training is very effective. So even if someone doesn't have a lot of training implements, there's a lot of ways to apply what we call interval training. An example of it would be, let's say that you're going for a run. You would sprint for about 30 seconds. You run as fast as you can. You don't even have to run as fast as you can. You just run fairly fast. And then you would go at a jogging pace for about a minute. And then you pick it up, go faster for 30 seconds, go at a jogging pace for a minute. And this is going to develop. Basically, you're going to start, you're using a similar mechanism to what sprinters have. And if you look at sprinters' physiques versus marathon runners, there's a big difference. So this interval training develops a lot of that fat tissue, muscle fibers. So applying interval training with a really good, healthy diet, just that combination, those are just two things that are simple to incorporate. They're not simple to actually apply and do. It takes some discipline. But just those two things would be very effective in terms of losing weight.
Okay. I understand you're a vegan, correct?
Yeah, I am, correct.
What other type? Most Americans like to eat meat, so...
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm very well versed in nutrition in general. Vegan to me is a personal thing that I do, and when someone shows an interest in it, I can steer them in the right direction. But as a strength coach and as a profession in this business, I look at different eating plans for a variety of people and get them on the right course. But for basically, I mean, my food philosophy for vegans or meat eaters, again, is very simple. You want to focus on real, organic, healthy food. A lot of people complain that organic food is too expensive, and I always say, well, then just be prepared to pay more for your medical insurance and medical bills as you get older, because what you fail to do now is going to turn into medical problems. I mean, most diseases, most health problems, genetics plays a role in a lot of cases. There's no doubt about that. But for a large part, we have a big control over avoiding diabetes and a lot of the health issues out there by what we consume, what we put in our body. And what most people put in their body, again, is most of the time just not even worthy of consumption. You're just eating chemical junk, which is going to have a lot of serious health consequences.
I agree with you 100%. In fact, with the kids that are in my program, I try to impress upon them the importance of eating, particularly on game days when we're in tournaments. A lot of kids, they'll show up and they haven't had any breakfast. You know,
right.
To eat, not even a banana or a piece of toast. You know, it's just some simple stuff they can do.
And what they ate the day before, a lot of times we look at what is a good pre-workout meal, but actually what you eat the day before, especially if it's a morning workout or a morning game, plays a huge role in what kind of energy reserves you're going to have for that day. So the dinner the night before could have been Pop-Tarts, you know, or some garbage food, and then you're just running. I mean, basically you're running on youth and you're running on adrenaline when you're getting away with still excelling at that age, but it's only going to last for so long. And the real problem is those years, teenager, 12 to 16, 12 to 18, I mean, those are the formative years where you're developing the eating habits that are going to last the rest of your life. I mean, a lot of people that are adults who eat a lot of junk food, they didn't start that when they were 18 or when they were adults. They've been doing that for a long time. So getting someone when they're young and getting them steered towards a much healthier diet and avoiding sugar at a very young age, because when you're giving a lot of kids ice cream and sweets, and it's okay to do this from time to time. I'm not saying never take your kid out for ice cream or never have a piece of cake on their birthday. You don't have to take it to those kind of extremes. But what we don't want to do is get kids addicted to sugar, which a lot of them are, at a very young age. And then we have problems like attention deficit disorder and a lot of other neural problems as well from this sugar addiction. And now we see a lot of kids that are drinking coffee and sugar, and I don't mean teenagers. I mean even younger than that. You go to Starbucks and some 10-year-old kid is ordering a Frappuccino. You know, there's something wrong with that picture.
I agree.
Well, if I can interject for a second, because this is like one of my biggest pet peeves. This is a subject that just gets me fired up because, you know, when you're talking about probably the age group that we are, which is probably the 10 to 14 age group, you know, it's funny how parents will tell their kids that they shouldn't eat stuff, but then the parents do it. And the habit is built in the home. So the parents have to be heavily involved. If the family is not going to back, endorse, and live a similar lifestyle, they can't expect the child to do it, especially at a young age when a lot of modeling of the family goes on. So, you know, I hate when overweight parents are yelling at their kids, stop eating fast food. You know, it goes on all the time. I see it all the time. And, you know, the parents need to be proactive in setting a good example and developing good habits for their children. As Mike said, you don't have to completely be antisocial to accomplish this. It's very realistic. But at the same time, too, you know, I get one of the most common questions I get from parents is, what else could my child be doing? And sometimes it's as simple as being prepared. You know, if you have a 12 o'clock game, don't wake up at 11.
Exactly.
You know, so yeah, exactly. I mean, I think anyone who's coached has been through that. And you know what? Those kids that want to perform, that go the extra mile, you know, I always use my own experience as a little background. You know, I wasn't a great athlete. What made me get to a level that, you know, is a pretty high level was the fact that I was willing to structure my life around my goal. And you know what? You can have a great life and you can do lots of fun things, but you need to prioritize the important things as well. And you know, it's like any other thing. I always make an analogy to business. You know, if you want to be a millionaire, you make a plan. If you want to be a great athlete, you have to make a great plan. If you want to lose body fat, you have to make a great plan. And I know Mike is a master at, you know, program design and things of that nature, and that's why his clients get such great results is because of the plan, not necessarily the tricks or the secret exercises he has.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Josh hit upon a great point as well, is the fact that you have to put sacrifice back into your vocabulary, which is something that a lot of people of all age brackets right now in society don't want to hear. And that's why we have massive credit card debt and the national savings rate is in negative territory. And it's because no one wants to make those sacrifices. We want to buy stuff that we can't afford. We want to eat stuff that's not healthy for us. And then what you often hear from people is some people that are really overweight, and you sit down with them and you start talking to them about, okay, here's how we're going to get you healthier and so forth. And they just look at the whole thing like it's a sacrifice. They go, well, I don't want to give up my cakes. I don't want to give up ice cream. I don't want to do this. I don't want to work out every other day. It's like, oh, well, just stay fat then. Just stay unhealthy. And I realized really early on that there's a certain kind of client that I'm going to enjoy working with and a certain kind that I'm not. So I built my business model around attracting the kind of people that I want to work with. And these are not necessarily people that are hardcore athletes. It's more of a hardcore mentality in terms of they're ready to do what's necessary to make tremendous positive changes in their life. And you really can't help somebody until they have that mindset where they want to do it for themselves and they just need some guidance and the support and the right information, but they're prepared to do what they need to do on an everyday level to change.
Absolutely. Well, Mike, we are almost coming to a conclusion of the show. I think we lost Josh. But maybe he'll call back in a second here. This whole aspect of nutrition is definitely another show, and we'd love to have you come back to talk about that as well as get Josh back on the line to talk about the sandbag trading, because that's actually
that'd be great.
Speaking for me. So before we end, though, I would like for you to again give your website address where folks can come and get some more information about the kettlebell training.
Sure. Thank you. My website, again, is mikemahler.com, and it's just mikemahler.com. That's all one word. And I have a lot of free information there just so people can educate themselves on what I'm all about, what my system is. So you don't have to come to my website and get bombarded with advertisements and marketing trying to get you to buy something. It's like, yes, I am a businessman, but at the same time, I want to make sure that my visitors, my readers are very educated on what's beneficial about my system and also have a lot of free information where they can test drive some concepts before going further.
Perfect. And we will also put up your information and links on the website at www.intenseathletics.com. That's I-N-T-E-N-Z-A-T-H-L-E-T. WTIX.com. Thank you very much, Mike, for your time. And, again, we'll look forward to having you back again to talk a little bit more about some nutrition and get into some information on this sandbag training.
Oh, sounds great, Rhonda. I really appreciate it.
Thanks much, and we'll talk soon.
Okay, thank you. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.